listener production.
Arthur Brooks is a Harvard professor where he teaches courses on leadership, happiness, and social entrepreneurship. He's also a columnist of the popular weekly How to Build a Life column at The Atlantic. From a young age, Arthur realised that happiness didn't come naturally to him and he had to work on it. Through that experience, he found that by following four pillars, anyone, no matter what their circumstances, can take control of their present and future rather than hoping and waiting for the outside world to improve. In the conversation that follows, we discuss why happiness doesn't come naturally for a lot of us, why people with faith are generally happier than those without it, and how the company you keep can be reflective of the quality of your mental health.
Choose your friends wisely. If all of your friends are, woe is me, everything's terrible, you've got the wrong friends. That's just the way it is. There's a reason that, you know, I'm a parent, I'm a grandparent. I wanted my kids when they were adolescents to have happy friends because I wanted my kids to be happier. Curate your company. Your company is the people, because of your brain and your mirror neurons, the people that you're going to be.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behaviour, personal growth and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. Arthur Brooks is the author of 13 books, including the 2023 number one New York Times bestseller, Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier, with his co-author, Oprah Winfrey. This conversation is not just about living well. It's an analysis of the habits and practices that produce that which we seek most, happiness. My hope is that this discussion ignites the inner change you seek most and guides you to reimagine what it means to be truly free from the shackles of our fears and, in the process, what it means to be human. Arthur, you are very well renowned as being a happiness expert. You're not a happiness person by nature. So can you talk to us a bit about your upbringing and also why to be a happy person doesn't mean you have to be born happy?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And great to be on your show. Happiness is something that I've been interested in for a long time. I'm a behavioral scientist. So I got my PhD a long time ago. And I wrote a book about happiness two decades ago, as a matter of fact, but I never quite treated it like something that you could affect. No, it's not something I could do with my own life. I observed it as if I were an astronomer, as if it were the stars. And that's a really important difference than an applied science itself. And the trouble with that is, you know, I'm a moderately unhappy person by nature. I have gloomy parents. I mean, I grew up in a gloomy place. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, which is known for its gloomy weather. And finally, my wife was actually from Barcelona. She said at one point, why don't you use the science that you've been studying all these years and see if the tools are something that you could change your habits with? And I thought, that's crazy. But then I thought, why not? And so I was doing another job. I was running a company, and not very happily for that matter. And I started putting together a strategic plan based on the best possible science, reading the neuroscience and social science literature, and keeping notes for myself. I completely changed my own life on the basis of it. And it was so unbelievably effective that I retired as the CEO of this company. And I went back to academia. I went to Harvard and started teaching this class on happiness and writing a column in The Atlantic, which is an American magazine that reaches about 500,000 people a week. And I have to tell you, it's been completely transformative. This is something that we can all get better at. Whether your nature is ebullient or melancholy, you can be a happier person. That's the guarantee, by understanding some of the science, applying it in your life, and most importantly, sharing it with others.
I totally agree with that, because I feel like my disposition isn't naturally happy. Like, I worry a lot and I overthink a lot. And I also used strategies when I started to learn about mindset many years ago, and those strategies were able for me to be very conscious about my thoughts and what I was doing that then enabled me to be in control of my happiness and my mood rather than it dictate me.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting thing because a lot of the time we don't watch our thoughts. And when we're not watching our thoughts, they'll just become chaotic. And a lot of that time that dictates what our mood is as well.
That's right. And what you're talking about is something that neuroscientists understand as being managed by your own limbic system. The limbic system is a console of tissues deep inside your brain that was evolved up, you know, between 2 and 40 million years ago. And what it does is it creates mood and emotion. Now, a lot of people have the mistaken understanding of emotion that it's good or bad, good feelings and bad feelings. There is no such thing. Emotions are nothing more than information to tell you whether or not something outside of yourself is an opportunity or a threat. And you need negative emotions such that you can be averse to dangerous situations in your life. You'd be dead in a week without negative emotions. The problem is when the emotions are dictated by the limbic system and they don't actually have you don't have an experience of these emotions in the prefrontal cortex, which is the most human part of the brain. So all the things that you're talking about, you just really adroitly described a process called metacognition, in which you become conscious of and try to manage your own emotions. And in so doing, you move the experience of the emotions to the executive centers of your brain. And with a series of very, very easy techniques, you can manage your feelings so they don't manage you. And that's what a lot of my work is actually about. Understand the brain, change your habits, change your life.
What are some of those techniques?
Well, to begin with, we have to understand that the emotions are being delivered to our prefrontal cortex so that we'll know how to react to a dangerous or a fortunate situation. So Mother Nature is funny. I mean, Mother Nature wants us to survive and pass on our genes. She does not care if we're happy. There is no evolutionary imperative for humans to be happy. We want to be happy, and a lot of times we have to stand up to our to Mother Nature, stand up to our emotional system. So all day long, the limbic system is delivering to your conscious brain these emotions all day long. Now, what happens is how you absorb these emotions, how you manage them, makes all the difference in the world. But they're very simple techniques that we're talking about and that I give people advice on every day. Now, a lot of people think they have to go to therapy in order to manage their emotions. And therapy can be quite useful for some people. But a lot of therapy is not useful at all. The only kind of therapy that really helps you is that which teaches you about yourself and teaches you how to manage yourself. And you can do that a lot more simply. Most meditation practices are incredibly helpful at making you observe yourself at a certain remove. So you'd say to yourself, Sarah is feeling sad today. Isn't that an interesting thing? Sarah had a pretty good sleep last night. Sarah has a wonderful life. But there's something that's bringing Sarah down. What might that be? And looking at it at that particular remove makes it possible for this not to be a ghost that's haunting your limbic system anymore. On the contrary, as you think about these things, you start to send signals backwards down the line and your limbic system starts to calm as a result. Another way to do this is by simple journaling. You know, people who keep a diary of their emotions, they, you know, keep lists of the things that are making them anxious or afraid. This is incredibly effective because when you take a pencil in your hand and a piece of paper, you can't be limbic. You have to be using your prefrontal cortex. There's simply no other way for you to be managing these emotions. It has to become conscious. And in so doing, it becomes a lot less scary. One of the ways that religious people do this is prayers of petition. If you're a religious person and you're praying to God that you get some relief from particularly stressful situations and articulating the belief itself, that what you're doing is you're becoming metacognitive. And all of these techniques are incredibly useful because once these are in your prefrontal cortex, you can choose your reaction to these emotions. You can substitute new emotions for the emotions that you don't as particularly like. You have incredible power, but you have to get good at doing it and no longer be a reactive person. I mean, the simplest, by the way, Sarah, the simplest technique that people use for metacognition, they're not aware they're doing it, is when they're angry, count to 10 before you speak. That's giving your prefrontal cortex time to catch up to your limbic system so you say what you want to say, not what you actually feel, which is just another example of metacognition.
It's interesting as well. I'm a big meditator and I feel that when you meditate, you've meditated for a period of time, in your eyes open life, the time between reaction to whatever's happened is far slower, and you have that time to be able to think and able to act. And, you know, I find a lot of my clients that have young kids, and before they started meditating or something like that, they'd react the whole time and they'd be shouting at their kids, and then they'd regret it. They'd feel bad because their kids are young, and that's part of being a child. But then when they were going into that meditative space, they would be far more conscious of what they were going to say before they exploded.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'm in London as I talk to you right now, and you get on the subway, the tube in London, and they always say, mind the gap. That's the gap between the car and the platform. Well, that's exactly what we need to do, is to mind the gap between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex, to extend the gap, have as much time as possible, literal time. And again, this is no joke, because the limbic system wants to make you act without thinking. If a car is speeding toward you, you see it peripherally. That's interpreted by the occipital lobe of your brain as a predator. That your brain can't say Mercedes. I mean, the Pleistocene brain doesn't have that kind of vocabulary. It says large predator that wants to come and kill and eat me. And so that registers as something that will light up the amygdala, the part of your limbic system that focuses on alarm, anger, and fear. You will jump out of the way and start sweating. It will send a signal all the way down to your adrenal glands above your kidneys to spit out stress hormones in 74 milliseconds. This is literally 3 or 4 seconds before your conscious brain can catch up. And so getting better at when you're feeling aversive emotions. I mean, you do need to jump out of the way of the car, by the way, but you don't need to scream at your children. And when you want to do something that's quite aversive, having an understanding of that gap and expanding it as much as possible through prayer, meditation, journaling, whatever the technique happens to be, you get much better at this. And you can get better at it quite quickly. It's interesting because it will also create more synaptic activity in your brain. One of the reasons that little kids are so reactive, I mean, they feel angry, they yell, they feel sad, they cry, they don't think about it at all, is because their brains are inadequately wired between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex. The full wiring doesn't occur until women are 21 and men are, I don't know, probably 70. I mean, it's no joke that this takes a long time, and you can actually create more synaptic activity by engaging in these metacognitive practices and get much better at this.
How do you define happiness?
Happiness is one of the most misunderstood things on the planet, which is actually one of the beginnings of the problem. Most people, when I ask, you know, and I ask my students, for example, I teach a large seminar on happiness at the Harvard Business School. And on the first day of class, I say, what's happiness? And they, one by one, they talk about their feelings. They say, it's the feeling I get when I'm with the people that I love. Or it's how I feel when I'm doing the things that I enjoy. So that's beautiful. That's great. That's wrong. That's not right. Happiness and feelings are related, but feelings are evidence of happiness. Happiness is not a feeling, and that's incredibly good news. Remember, feelings have everything to do with what's going on outside you. And if you're chasing feelings, then you're just going to be hoping for the best. You're going to be hoping that nothing bad ever happens to you. And I mean, if you didn't have negative emotions, it would be deadly for you. And so therefore, you'd be chaining your happiness to only nice things happening all the time, which is completely impossible in this life. Bad things are going to find you. The point is that we need to understand that happiness has, you know, its evidence, which is feelings, but we can directly affect the true macronutrients of what happiness is. Now, I'm making a metaphor, of course. You have food, any dinner that you eat has a smell. That's like the feelings from your happiness. That's evidence of the happiness. But the food itself has these three very distinct macronutrients. It's protein, carbohydrates, and fat. Everybody knows this. And to get healthier, you need to balance and have an abundance of these macronutrients. The same thing is true with happiness. Happiness has feelings as kind of its smell, but the happiness itself is made up of enjoyment, satisfaction, and meaning. Those are the three macronutrients of happiness. And this is important to understand, because when we talk in the American Declaration of Independence about pursuing happiness, that's too general. What we really need to do is to pursue enjoyment in our lives, satisfaction with our accomplishments and what we're doing in our work, and meaning in the why questions of why we exist. And once we pursue those things in a very scientific and very strategic way, which is what I write about all the time. I mean, when I go into a company at this point, or a classroom, or I'm talking to anybody, and I ask just a few questions, I can find out where their macronutrient profile is messed up and how they can actually start getting happier. Some people just don't enjoy their lives enough. Some people are not doing the thing that will give them appropriate satisfaction with purpose and direction and goals. Some people just, they simply don't have meaning. They don't understand the why questions to their lives. And so this is one of the things that I work on an awful lot. Happiness is enjoyment, satisfaction, and meaning.
Let's talk about that in relation to job satisfaction, because you have your book, Build the Life You Want, that you have written with Oprah. And you talk about that within the book about how I think it's 80% of our time is spent at work. So having a job that gives you some sort of meaning and you feel that makes a big difference to your happiness levels. And I know for me, many years ago, I was in jobs that I hated. There was one in particular I worked in when I was, I would have been maybe early 20s or something. It just was the worst. For 1 year, I drove there just hating life. And I wasn't a happy person. And come the weekends, I was unhappy because I knew that in 2 days I was going back to this awful job. And as I started to find work that was more meaningful, and now in the job that I'm in now, I couldn't be happier. It's probably the happiest I've ever been. And it's because it's also a job that is of service.
Right.
So I want to know a bit about your research into that and what people can do if they find themselves in a job that they're not enjoying, but they also find it hard because they need the money that comes with that job.
Yeah. So it's pretty easy to say, hey, you don't like your job, go get a new one. That's too easy. You can't, not everybody can do that. That's not practical for a lot of people if you have little kids or you live in a particular place where the job market isn't so great. I've done a lot of research on what brings joy through work. And work is one of the great authentic sources of joy or misery in your life, depending on how it's set up, just as you say. And it turns out that the characteristics of jobs that bring a lot of joy don't involve money or power or prestige or job title or any of the stuff, the outward signs that we're always going for. I mean, we always say, well, take the job that pays the most, or if I get a promotion, then I'll be happy. If I could be the boss, then things would be great. None of those things are true, by the way. It doesn't mean that you'll be miserable if you make more money. I mean, good for you. If you get more power, then you're able to do all kinds of good things. That might be nice, but that's not going to bring you happiness. Happiness at work comes from two forces. We call them earned success, which is, I have to explain, and then there's service to others, which is pretty straightforward, but not always easy to get. Earned success means you feel that you're creating value with your job and life for other people, and you're being rewarded and acknowledged for it. This is why merit-based systems at work are so critically important and why people are often so frustrated inside government service. Government service is important. It has to get done. But too many government agencies, they don't have merit-based systems. They have seniority-based systems. And there's nothing that frustrates people more than, you know, hey, if I just hang around long enough, I'll make more money. Now, you want to be rewarded for doing, people seeing that you're doing a good job and being recognized and acknowledged and rewarded for being a really good job. This is just the human way that we want. And you, if you're able to do this inside your workplace, people just won't leave. People won't want to leave because it's so incredibly satisfying for them, of course, especially your highest performers, which are the people that you need to actually hang around. So that's a great source of joy. The second is you need to understand that your work is making life better for other people, and you need to be able to see them. This is so, I mean, it can't be theoretical. And, you know, I've seen this in many, many workplaces where the boss gets all of this acknowledgement for helping other people and all the thanks that come from the clients or the, you know, the people that they're serving. But people lower down in the totem pole in the job, they're not feeling that love so very much. That changed when I found that I was actually a CEO and I was running a company and it changed the way that I worked. I was running a big research organization in Washington, D.C. And we would serve the White House, we would serve Congress, and you know, famous politicians would call me up and say, thank you. You know, this is really helping me do my work better. I'm serving the American people. And it would make me feel so good. And I thought, you know, I bet you the people who work in the cafeteria in the mailroom have no idea how important this product is that they're part of. Because, you know, we're not going to get it done if we don't eat. We're not going to get it done if we don't get our mail. That's just the way it is. So I started bringing in these politicians to talk to people all through the organization. And Sarah, it was a game changer because people said they really appreciate what I'm doing. I guarantee you they went home and said to their spouse, a senator thanked me today for working at the American Enterprise Institute, which is the company. And that was what they needed. I mean, they have to make a living. You know, you can't exploit people and underpay them. I've always made a really big deal about paying people more than you have to, as much as you can, actually, because that's incredibly motivating as well for all sorts of ethical reasons. But really, the joy comes when people feel like they're earning their success and serving others.
That's so interesting. And how do you feel like purpose fits into that?
Well, purpose and work is all about goals and direction. So purpose really has to do with your own personal career trajectory. Mm. And I study this a lot because I work with young people. My average student is 28 years old. They're about to go out on the market and do great things. I mean, people who graduate from the Harvard Business School, they tend to go on and do important things in business, for sure. What I talk to them about is understanding the nature of their own goals and direction, which can be very personal. And it's quite important. I mean, it's actually pretty interesting. The research shows that the direction of your career takes one of four basic paths. The world tells you it's one thing, but there are three others. And we really need to understand this. And so this might be actually interesting to listeners who felt a little bit out of place in whatever career direction that they're in. They feel a little bit like misunderstood. This might be the reason. The world says that we're supposed to be very career-oriented, very ambitious, and very, very linear. And linear means you take a job and you only change jobs when something is better for money or power or acclaim, you know, prestige. That's when you take the next thing. And that's how you're supposed to go through your life. And if you don't do that, then there's something wrong with you and you're not ambitious and you're some sort of a loser. And a lot of people are very linear, to be sure. I have a lot of linear students. I mean, they're gonna be incredibly successful as a result of that. But the three others, number one is called the expert path or the steady state career path. These are people who, they don't live to work, they work to live. And so they want a job that will support their lives and their family. And they don't want to be thinking about work all the time. They're just not work machines. You know, and I realize I'm an American, and so we have this reputation for all being work machines, but we're not. I mean, there's lots of people that want to, you know, live near their families and have weekends off. And when they go home from work, don't want to be thinking about work. And they're very equilibrated on that. My father was that way. You know, I'm an academic. My father was an academic. His father was an academic, as a matter of fact. And when my father was, you know, he came home from work, he didn't think about work. He didn't want to think about work. He didn't care if he got huge raises. And so the result was you just steady, 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 do the same thing for a long time. Don't look for the job where they're going to be up or out, where they're going to be pushing you and trying to kill you. The next one is called the transitory career pattern. A lot of young people follow this today, and they actually would not work if they didn't have to, but they kind of have to. And so their work will be this or that, depending on what they're most interested in. And so they'll be, you know, driving a truck out of Portland, Maine, because that, you know, supports something that they met a group of people they wanted to hang around. And then they, you know, fall in love with a girl in San Diego. And so they move there and become a barista for a little while. And that's the transitory career pattern. That's what everybody's mother is afraid of, quite frankly. But the most interesting one that a lot of people are going to be listening to this podcast, and I think that you've had this in your career as well, is called the spiral career pattern, which is a series of miniature careers of your own design, where you actually see what you want to build with your life, and your life is your enterprise. Your company's not your enterprise. Your career is not something that's being controlled by anybody. And sometimes you'll be doing something that pays more, and sometimes it'll pay less. Generally, these people work in a particular career for 7 to 10 years and then start over, do something completely new. It's a for-profit now, and then it's a nonprofit. And then maybe you take 7 years off or go part-time to raise your children and then come back in, and then you want to teach for a little while. And it's all makes sense inside your head. That's really important that you allow yourself to do that, because if you're a spiral, you'll always be unhappy on the linear pattern.
There's something in knowing that you have some control over your own emotions and not your destiny as such, but the way that you move through the world. I feel that people that truly believe that are happier people than people that think, oh, it was just bad luck that this happened and, you know, woe was me and bad things always happen to me. And you feel that those people sometimes will say, oh, they attract negative things to them. But it's also the way that they're showing up in the world and the way that they are projecting out to the world that gets them in that horrible loop, I find.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. There's a whole literature on what's called locus of control.
Yeah.
You know, where do you think that things come from? And internal locus of control means I'm going to work on myself, because most things start internally. External locus of control is I'm going to try to control the outside world, and I'm going to be frustrated when I can't. One of the biggest problems that we have with mental health among young adults is that leaders have been encouraging young people to develop the identity of victim. And so there's kind of a virtue of victimization. There's kind of a victimhood complex. And the identity comes from grievance a lot of the time on college campuses in the States, probably in Australia, Tumby, also because, you know, I mean, the world is flat at this point. There's a whole lot of kind of activism that says you're a victim and a lot of your status is going to be coming from the level of grievance that you feel. This is the best way to make young people clinically depressed and generalized and have generalized anxiety. The best way to encourage mental illness among young people is to encourage that they have an external locus of control. To begin with, it's not true. The truth of the matter is that internal locus of control is much more descriptive of the experience that most people have of their lives. And we have to pay attention and respect this and help people. Now, I get it why leaders are doing this. You know, media figures and politicians and campus activists and faculty, they want foot soldiers in their culture war. That's what they want. And the way that you get that is miserable, angry, sad people. Those people will follow you anywhere because you become their external locus of control. You become their savior. These are cults that are happening. That's what's happening in politics today. But until we actually can encourage each one of ourselves and others to adopt an internal locus of control, we're going to have a lot of the problems that we see today.
I want to talk about that hope piece as well because that's something that I've always believed in. And I know there's been a lot of research from Viktor Frankl is obviously someone that you reference in your book and also is sort of the psychiatrist that a lot of people refer to when we think about hope. And for people that don't know who he is, he was in Auschwitz and his whole family died. He was in the concentration camp for many years. And he noticed that the people that had hope lived longer, even though they might have had the same health conditions as someone else next to them that didn't have hope. He could almost calculate when that person would die or that would be the end for them. And I want to know what you have learned about hope and how that kind of relates even to the disease that people have these days.
Hope is a, you know, in most religious traditions is a virtue to be cultivated. It's not optimism. You know, a lot of people really want to be optimistic. And optimism is correlated with happiness for sure. But all optimism is a prediction. Optimists are saying about something about probabilities. I think everything's going to be okay. That's optimism. Hope doesn't necessarily make that assumption. Hope says something can be done and I can do it. That's what hope is. Hope is incredibly active. You can be a hopeful pessimist. You can say, yeah, I got a really bad diagnosis from my doctor, but there's something that I'm going to do and I'm going to do it. That's a hopeful pessimist, as a matter of fact. And there's sometimes when pessimism is warranted. I mean, things might not look so great, but there's always something that you can do. And recognizing that gives you a sense of direction, gives you a sense of purpose and meaning. And so one of the things that I do when I'm working with people is move them toward hope. You know, and this is a choice that you can make because there's always something that you can do. This is what's called emotional substitution, by the way, Sarah. So people will be experiencing the emotion of dreadful pessimism. And I'll say, focus on what you can do, which will choose hope and substitute it for the pessimism that you're feeling in your life. And that will just absolutely, you know, it will move, it will inflect your happiness in the right direction, completely guaranteed. There's all of these substitute emotions that you can actually adopt. So some people will, from their sad, they will adopt humor as a different emotion because you can do that. Absolutely. When you're really sad, it's actually pretty funny, guaranteed. And you can actually start making jokes if you're looking for it. This is one of the reasons that professional comedians are often clinically depressed people who've gotten very good at emotional substitution. So hope is just another substitute emotion. You can always choose it. Say, what can be done and what can I do now? Those are the two questions. When you ask those two questions and you answer them to your satisfaction, your mood will change and your life will change.
What do people do if they're around people that, you know, are Debbie Downers and who are always the glass is half full and it's always woe is me or look out for the negative and they haven't been trained in looking for happiness and that's not something they're interested in. But this could be their family, it could be their friends, someone, it could be their partner even. I know people that have partners that are very negative and it can be very hard for them. How does someone deal with that?
Yeah. So that's a problem of what we call emotional contagion. When you're around people who are very, very unhappy, it's very easy for that to lower your level of life satisfaction a lot. And there's a reason that we tend to have contagious emotions. Humans are made to live in groups. We're not made to live alone. We're not made to be hermits. We're not made to be recluses. We're both a pair bonded and tribal species designed to live in tropical locations. That doesn't mean we can't live in places like England and Seattle, but it's a lot healthier to live in places like Australia for our sort of natural habitat. We're also supposed to live in groups and we're supposed to pair bond with each other. I mean, this is how we're basically designed, which is why people are happiest under these circumstances, is what we find. Now, the problem with that is that when we're a tribal and we're made for kin groups, is that when somebody's really struggling, that we're supposed to, or have any emotion, we're supposed to feel the emotion of people in our kin group. That's why we've developed called mirror neurons. These are neurons that exist, and these are nerve cells in our brains that are dedicated to ascertaining the emotions of other people and feeling them within ourselves. This is what one of the things that bonds us to each other. And that's great. When your partner is happy, you get happier. The problem is when your partner is unhappy, you get unhappier, and it can really degrade the quality of your life. Yeah, and you're not going to change your mirror neurons, but there's certain things you can do with your behavior to make things better for yourself and your partner or your friend or whoever it happens to be. To begin with, the most important thing that you can do when you're living with somebody or you're around somebody who's chronically negative is work on your own happiness. Why? Because when you do that, that will counteract the mirror neuron activity and you can start a reverse emotional contagion to the other person. So you have to do the work. In other words, don't just give and give and give and give. On the contrary, before you see an unhappy person for the first day, do what you need to do for your own happiness. Do your prayer, do your journaling, do your meditation, do the things that you actually need to do, all the protocols that we all talk about in the science of happiness. Make sure you do your exercise. Make sure you do the things that you need to do to take care of your own happiness. That will make it possible for you to fend off a lot of the negative contagion and to start to reverse it into a positive contagion. The second thing that I recommend for a lot of young people is that choose your friends wisely. If all of your friends are you know, woe is me, the world's so bad, everything's terrible, you've got the wrong friends. That's just the way it is. That's the reason that, you know, I'm a parent, I'm a grandparent. I wanted my kids when they were adolescents to have happy friends. That's what I wanted, because I wanted my kids to be happier. That's what I wanted. And so when they were around people that were really, really negative, I was always discouraging them from, you know, developing those particular relationships. And it really, really helped a lot. So curate your company. Your company is the people, because of your brain and your mirror neurons, the people that you're going to be.
That's so interesting. I wonder with kids, you know, I've got two kids myself, and sometimes they'll come home from school and they'll just point out all the negative things that have happened in the day. And I think to myself, like, I'm sure something that was good happened. Or if something good happened, you won't hear from them that day. They won't say how school was unless you ask them. But a lot of the time, and adults do this too, we just focus on them, like, how was your day? Oh, well, this bad thing happened, that bad thing happened. We forget the majority of good things that happened in the day. Why do we do that? And then if you're a parent to a child that does that, how can we start to get them to focus on the positives rather than the negatives?
Couple things that are going on there that are worth pointing out. So I remember that when my kids were little, I would pick them up from preschool. They wouldn't see me and they would be playing with their friends and having a great time, smiling, laughing, running around. And as soon as they saw me, they would come running over and burst into tears. I'd be like, what? What did I do? Why do I deserve this? And it turns out because they store up their negative emotion and then they share it with the one person they trust. That's a very human thing to do. And that's one of the reasons that spouses will be fine at work all day and then come home and complain to their spouse. Because you only share the negative emotion with the people you trust. Mm. It's a very important. Why? Because you share it at work, you don't trust those people, it can have negative repercussions. But you really trust your partner, you really trust your parents, you really trust your closest friends. And so there's a vibe of negativity because it's all stored up. It's like you open up your briefcase of negatives and you take one thing out all one after the other. And that can feel really bad for the partner or the parent, right? But when you have little kids and they're doing that, actually be thankful because you're the person that they trust the most. That's an expression of their trust and their love for you. And they know they're safe to get rid of all of their horribles, to launder their horribles with you is the one thing. The second thing, however, is that there is a tendency to focus how did your day go, to focus on the negative parts of the day because of what we call the negativity bias. Now, negativity bias is an ancient evolutionary phenomenon where you're supposed to focus more on negative than positive because that will keep you alive. You know, if somebody's smiling sweetly at you from across the room at a party, that's nice. But if somebody's frowning angrily at you, you better take note, because that could be a big problem for you once you get outside on the street. And that's a big deal. That's one of the reasons that if you go out to dinner with your friends and it's a super fun time, you're having a great time, but then there's a bad argument right at the end of the night, that's all you remember about the night forever. Because that negativity caught your attention because your evolved brains that always pay attention to the negative thing. Your kids don't know that. And so one of the things that we have to do in all of our lives is to routinely focus on the on more positive parts of our experiences so that we can manually increase their salience. So the natural salience is negative. The manual salience that we'll bring up can be positive. And we can do that with our kids around the dinner table by saying, let's talk about the most fun, best thing that happened today. What's the best thing that happened today? You know, and what that'll do is they'll get them into the practice basically of gratitude. The gratitude practice is focusing on the positive as opposed to letting the negativity bias remain in the most salient position. So number one, don't worry when they complain to you. That means they love and trust you. But number two, help them get into the habit of not focusing on that for the rest of the day by counteracting the negativity bias.
What do we do with children that overthink and worry too much and get anxious? Because we find a lot of that these days, especially with social media and all that kind of stuff, where a lot of parents are telling me that their kids are anxious to do certain things. And, you know, I know every person's wired differently, but for myself, I remember not having any anxiety. I actually remember the first time I felt anxiety, I was 18 years old. Like, that's pretty decent to have gone a whole like that long without having felt anxiety. I actually didn't even know what it was. That's why I clearly remember, because I was like, what is this feeling? And my dad told me. But what do we do these days? Because I feel like it's so prevalent. All we hear about is that kids, some of them are struggling so bad and they're crippled with anxiety or worry.
Yeah. So a couple of things to think about. Number one, the number one source of anxiety for young people is social media. Protect your kids from social media. Letting your kids have unimpeded access to devices with social media is like giving your kids liquor when they're eight. Mm. Don't do that. You're damaging your children by giving them that way too much access to it. As a matter of fact, they say that in the States, you can't sign up for social media accounts legally until you're 13. That's way too young. It should be 18. It should be 21. It should be never, Sarah, because it's not good for any of us, but especially the developing brain is a bit, you know, social media can be poison for them. That's the number one thing. So parents have to be a lot more aggressive about it. I know they're not gonna like you. They're not gonna like you if you don't give them, you know, smart devices. But there's a whole range of devices that they can use that can only be used for, you know, taking memos and calling mom. And those are the devices that young people should have. They shouldn't have unimpeded access to the internet and to social media. It's just, that's what's actually creating a mental health problem, wave, you know, a crisis, a pandemic of mental health problems among you know, minors that we're seeing. That's the number one reason. So that's critical. The second big problem that they're having is that they don't have enough social contact and they're not allowed to have enough uninterrupted playtime where they're setting their own rules and doing their own thing. We're way too worried about the safety of kids and we keep them apart from others. We also mediate their disputes. The second way that we create tons of anxiety is making them think that they can't deal with their own conflict and their own problems. And the way that we do that is by saying, if you're having a problem at school, give me a call, I'll call the teacher. Yeah. If you're having a dispute with another child, I'll adjudicate that dispute. You can't walk to the store by yourself because somebody might snatch you. And we're installing this unbelievable anxiety and worry on them by telling them that they're incompetent for taking care of themselves. This is the reason that certain demographic groups of particularly women in the United States under 30, about over 50% of been diagnosed with a mental illness at this point. Wow. And what they'll do is they'll get really addicted to a relationship with a therapist where they can't make a single move without calling an adult, without calling somebody my age. That's just insanity. I mean, look, you're 21, you're grown up. You should be able to move away and take a job and pay your rent, you know, drive your car and do your things and take care of your emotional life as well. But we've stolen this from young people. We've replaced it with dangerous technologies and we've stolen it from them by telling them effectively they're incompetent. These are the two things that we really, really need to do if we want to take care of our kids and have healthier, happier, less fearful children.
What if something happens in someone's life? So something that is quite traumatic. It could be the loss of someone or a diagnosis or just some sort of trauma. What do we do to find happiness if that's going on when we feel like the world is very dark and seems like a time where how could happiness be available?
Yeah. And you know, the truth is that everybody has these times in their life, sometimes really severe and ghastly. And for some people, it's a lot less terrible, but nobody is going to escape suffering. That's the way. And here's the good news about that, Sarah. We talk an awful lot about post-traumatic stress disorder and the problems that come from stress that make it difficult to live our lives. 90% of people, at least, when they have a terrible thing, like a death of a close family member, something really, really damaging, in over 90% of the cases, people wind up growing from the experience more than anything else. In other words, the danger and or the damage from the trauma is less pronounced than the growth that actually comes from the trauma. And that's it. This is actually one of the things that's very important for us to understand, that suffering is sacred, that you simply won't become a happy, healthy, well-developed person if you don't suffer. The way to happiness lies through a lot of unhappiness. And so one of the things I talk about with my students and anybody who talks to me about this is they need to not be so afraid of things that are hard and terrible. I mean, it's like back in the 60s, the hippies used to say, if it feels good, do it. Now the mantra is kind of, if it feels bad, make it stop. But that's equally stupid. That's an equally terrible way to run your life. On the contrary, nobody wants suffering. I don't want suffering. I don't. But I have to look at it as the path through which I'm actually going to have a better life, not a worse life. And so one of the best things that we can actually do and to train ourselves to do is to say, look, when inevitably things happen, I have to submit to the, I'm not going to say bring it on. I'm not going to go looking for suffering, but fortunately I don't have to because it will find me. That I can say, I understand that I'm going to learn from something from this and I'm going to start focusing on the learning right now. The most important thing that I can do is actually say, what am I learning from this? And so I have an exercise that brings this, that makes this very tangible for my students. I make my students keep a failure journal. Now, a failure journal is, you know, this is not as traumatic as my mother died. You know, it's not as traumatic as my business went bankrupt and I was temporarily homeless. That's in a different scale. But everybody's having significant things that bother them pretty regularly. And when you're 28, it's like every Thursday, something really bad, something that feels really bad happens to you. By the time you're my age at 59, it's like, it wasn't that bad. And so you have a more of a perspective on these things as it turns out. But still, there's things I don't like. A failure journal is one in which every time something you really, really don't like, a disappointment, something that makes you really sad, something that makes you feel really rejected, somebody says, I don't love you, you know, whatever it happens to be. It's like, ah, catastrophic. Don't push it away. Write it down in your failure journal and leave two lines under each entry. The first one you're going to come back to after 1 month. The second one you're going to come back to after 6 months. You set alarms to come back and look at these things or just come back and regularly look at them. 1 month after you've written this thing down, let's just say you got your first big job coming out of school and you think it's going really well and you go for your first performance review and your job says, I would say this is B minus work. And this is devastating. I mean, and you know, one of the things that people say about young people today is that they're hard to work with because they've never gotten a bad grade. You know, nobody's ever said bad job, and so they're not used to it. They don't have any experience in that. And that makes it harder for them to take it. So, okay, you write it down and say, I thought I was doing a good job, but my boss said I was barely making it. You come back after a month, and you'll write down something like, I thought that was going to bother me for the rest of my life, quite frankly, and it bothered me for like a week. That's an important thing to learn. And it's an important thing to remember. Why? Because emotions are transient but feel permanent. And you have to learn that. Mother Nature wants you to think you're going to suffer forever so you'll avoid rejection of bad things. But they can't last forever because Mother Nature can't afford to let you keep feeling something bad. You have to be ready for the next thing to make you feel bad or good. Okay. So whatever you learned, whatever it happened to be, or you might say, I learned that I wasn't actually a fit when I thought I was. Now you come back 6 months later and you say, you're supposed to write down after 6 months, tell me one good thing that happened as a result of that learning. And it might be, I realized since I wasn't as good a fit as I thought that I should go on the market and I found a better job and I'm a lot happier. And then you start getting, you start looking forward to writing in your failure journal. You really start looking forward to it because you know learning and growth and happiness are going to come as a result of it. You're just going to have to wait.
I want to talk about having faith and spirituality and religion because we know that that makes us happier. And Oprah says this beautiful passage in your book. She says, "I've been guided by a divine hand my whole life." And I know for her, that made her life a lot happier. I know for me, it's been forefront in making me a much happier person. But I want to know your research with this and your own experiences.
Yeah, so I've studied what I call transcendental experiences almost my whole career. And transcendental experiences are those that put you in a state of awe and make you feel small. And, you know, Mother Nature doesn't want you to feel small. She wants you to be the star of your psychodrama. You know, Sarah's job and Sarah's commute and Sarah's lunch and Sarah's money and Sarah's TV shows. It's just so boring, it'll drive you crazy. It'll make you mad, quite frankly. What you need to do is to zoom out on your life. Now, there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, my friend Ryan Holiday, what he does is he studies the Stoic philosophers for the sense of meaning and purpose in life. Some people have a more of a kinetic meditative experience of walking in nature before dawn. There's a whole theory in Vedic wisdom called the Brahma Muhurta, the creator's time, in which if you get up an hour and a half before dawn and to move and pray, you'll have acute sensibilities for the rest of the day. And there's a lot of research that shows that that's true. A lot of brain science shows that that's true. And they'll walk for an hour before dawn without devices. Without devices, very important. Some people will study the works of Johann Sebastian Bach or something like that of great genius to stand in awe. Some people will undertake meditation. I've studied with the Tibetan Buddhist monks for many years to understand these techniques. I'm going in 3 weeks to Dharamsala to work with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for a conference that I'm doing with my lab at Harvard. And I'm going to sit with and study with his monks when I'm there. And some people, they practice the faith of their youth. I'm a practicing Catholic, literally the most important thing in my life. And it does the trick, Sarah. It's critically important. Now, there's a lot of research that shows that what it does to the brain, it accesses parts of the brain that give you acute awareness of experiences that you would not get any other way. And most importantly, it makes you small because you experience the transcendent. And there's literally nothing that substitutes for these transcendent experiences in the happiness equation.
What have been some experiences that you've had to do with awe and feeling like there's something much bigger than what we can see?
Most of my experiences that have been very profound and very impacting on me have been religious experiences. So I've been on many pilgrimages. So for example, I've walked the Camino de Santiago, which is this very famous Christian pilgrimage across northern Spain. And the whole idea is that walking can be a form of prayer, which it is in almost every tradition. Almost every tradition has walking prayers because ambulation is you integrate your heart and your legs and your breathing with your worship. And you know, there's the Russian Orthodox will pray the famous Jesus prayer, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me." And the first part is on the inhale and the second part is on the exhale. And then they'll link it with their heart and then they'll start to walk. "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me." They'll do it 10,000 times. Well, I walked the Camino de Santiago, which is an ancient Catholic pilgrimage, which is hundreds of kilometers across northern Spain. And all you do is walk and pray. All you do in nature, you walk and pray. You get up before dawn. You walk for hours. You're not walking that far. It's about 30 kilometers a day. It's not, you know, it's not crazy. You have to be in decent shape, but you know, you don't have to be some sort of Olympic athlete to do it. And by the time you get to Santiago de Compostela, which is a very famous end of the pilgrimage where the remains of St. James the Apostle are laid to rest at the cathedral, it's this incredible spiritual achievement in self-transcendence. And people get there, they get to the plaza and they break down, they weep, and they're not religious and they don't know what's going on. And what's happening is this intense experience of transcendence that happens along the way. It's just completely life-changing. It's completely life-changing. I've done it 2 times. And it's changed my life so much. I'm going on a pilgrimage to Fatima in Portugal in 3 weeks for my birthday. I can't wait. I can't wait to go because it's going to be an experience for me of intense prayer. Something where that's really all I have to do. I do a 3-day silent retreat every year. And I recommend everybody, all my students and everybody listening to us, to do a silent retreat, to be silent with your thoughts such that you can discern your path. You can't discern your path if you're not listening. You know, and listening is critically important. And life is all about yelling and talking and not listening. We don't listen enough. Here's the central idea of these transcendent experiences is as follows. We all think we're looking for something. We're seeking, looking. But in the moments of silence, when you really understand your life, you look back and you realize that you were being sought. You know, you have two kids, right, Sarah? And in the moments of real clarity, you realize that they were seeking you even before they were born. Mm. The people who love you are seeking you. God is seeking you. But you have to stop and let yourself be found. Mm. You have to stop. And that's an insight that eluded me for a long time. But now that I allow myself to be found because I'm the one who sought, my life has changed for the better.
There was a beautiful theologian, John O'Donohue, and he said it's when spirituality is knowing that there's something rather than nothing. And I think that's so beautiful. Like, it's so simple. Like, just having that knowledge, I feel, makes you walk in the world with your head higher. And I know for myself, when I go into prayer every day after my meditation, it's not that sort of prayer where we think of, like, in the past, you know, they've on TV shows, you see standing like, oh, give me this, crying and wailing and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, how may I serve? And I feel that when we're doing that, there is this sense of selflessness that comes. And I know for myself, when I get out of that, I just feel like I'm fueled to start the day. Like, there is so much more happiness within me by setting that as my first kind of routine for the day, like meditation, prayer, and then back into the wide world with my eyes open to start the day.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot of science to back up exactly what you're saying. This is an experience that people would be wise to learn from you. I start my day with a Brahma Muhurta. I start my day, you know, before the sun comes up every day. I get up at 4:45 in the morning. I start by exercising vigorously to really move my body. And so I exercise for an hour every day. Then I go to Mass. I go to Catholic Mass. I try to go to Catholic Mass literally every day, where I start my day in worship and prayer. And then I come back and only then do I eat and drink coffee and, you know, do all these kind of human things. And part of the reason for that is that I'm optimizing my brain chemistry as well as my sense of transcendence. And you shouldn't drink, you've had Andrew Huberman on your show. And yeah. So he's probably mentioned that you shouldn't drink coffee within the first 90 to 120 minutes in the morning. And the reason is because coffee is not to wake you up. Coffee is to help you focus. You know, you shouldn't wake up with a chemical. You can use it as a you know, an enhancement to your focus. So then I'll drink my coffee and I'll get 3 or 4 uninterrupted hours of creativity and intense focus that I wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. But it required that I start with body and soul. Start with body and soul before dawn. This is the most useful little protocol that I give to a lot of young people who are having trouble getting started with their lives, is to get up before dawn, move your body, and say your prayers. That's the thing to do. And if you do just those three things, also make your bed. If you do those things, your life is just, it's just going to be different, is the bottom line. And I can give you the science till the cows come home, but I don't need to. You just need to experience once or twice and you're not going to want to go back.
What's your favorite prayer?
The Jesus prayer. Hmm. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. The longer version is, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, have mercy on me, a sinner. It doesn't breathe in just the same way, but I've been saying that to go to sleep every night for the past 15 years. I say that every single night to go to sleep, because what it basically says is that it's an acknowledgement of who I am and who I love is really what it comes down to. And it's easy, and it's easy to repeat, and it's a form of meditation, and it really speaks to me. What's your favorite prayer, Sarah?
The prayer of St. Francis.
Ah, nice.
It's long. But I say that every morning.
It's a litany of humility, for sure. Yeah, that's right. You know, every night, things that I recommend when it comes to faith and spirituality is using it as a form of intimacy, which is critically important as well, that people, they don't recognize that the most intimate act you can engage in with your romantic partner is prayer. Mm. And most people don't pray together. They just don't do it. Even if they're both religious or both, you know, meditative, they don't use prayer together. I mean, they're more likely to have physical intimacy than spiritual intimacy. Why? Because spiritual intimacy is more intimate. And so one of the things that I recommend is that when people are in love is to start praying together, because this will lock you, this will interlock your spirits in ways. It dramatically increases the likelihood of a permanent pair bond is actually this joint metacognitive kind of activity, which is prayer. So my wife and I, every night before we go to bed, we pray the rosary together, the Catholic rosary together, which is it's a long prayer. It's 25 minutes of the same prayers again and again and again. It's 53 repetitions of the Hail Mary prayer. Wow. It's the Our Father, which is the Lord's Prayer again and again and again. And it's a whole series of interlocking prayers, and it's call and repeat. So she says the first half, I say the second half. I say the first half, she says the second half. And we're talking to each other while in a conversation that's being intermediated by God himself. It's incredibly intimate, and it helps you sleep, frankly, for all sorts of reasons you can imagine. You know, don't have the TV on when you do it. And it also brings us together, reminds us that we are meant to be together, you know, for the rest of our lives. And there's no doubt about that, that, you know, and that God is our partner in this lifelong journey, hand in hand.
I love that. What is a life of greatness to you?
A life of greatness is a one where you live up to the commitments of love that you make in your life. The happiest people, they do four things. They have their faith or philosophy on point. They have family relationships that are functional. They have real friendships and not just deal friendships. And they have work that loves and serves. Really, a life of greatness is one that recognizes the eternal truth of happiness, which is that happiness is love. Love of the divine, love of your family, love of others, and love expressed toward the entire world with the way that you earn your daily bread. That's a true life of greatness, whether you're a postal worker or a professor, politician, or a podcaster. That is a life of greatness as far as I'm concerned. It is the highest calling to which each of us can live, is to live a life that focuses and centers on love.
Arthur Brooks, this has been such an insightful conversation. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me on, and thanks to all your listeners for living happier and lifting other people up.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. Listener.